If I can be a Christian social activist, anybody can be a Christian social activist. The meaning of that is that I went from absolutely zero on activism, Christianity, and social. Yeah, even social. And ended up just about the opposite of that. I'm not here as an expert. I don't have any credentials, academic degrees that are pertinent anyway. I don't have any amazing personal experiences that other people couldn't have had. I'm here because as I was at a staff meeting, and people were going around the room talking at a teaching staff meeting, talking about what they were going to be teaching about, I realized that not all of them were doing things in a specific field, you know, that was their area of expertise. They were doing things that they knew something about through a lot of different channels. And I thought that in the face of all the expertise, experience, and talent that's gathered at Holden, that it's important that somebody testify that a not-so-expert, less-than-experienced, far-from-talented person can also be called very firmly by God to help create a vision of God's kingdom and can be transformed by God to be enabled to do that. Apparently some others thought it might be important since I did get scheduled, so here I am. As Dan and Charlie talked about in their session last week, I intend to tell my story. I'm hoping that it will serve mostly as a catalyst for reflection and sharing of your stories about your journeys of faith and action. My plan is to leave most of our time for discussion. We'll see if my plans work out. My story will necessarily be personal and Holly-centered. In fact, I'm going to be working very hard at talking only about me so that I don't get tempted to preach or sound preachy or try to tell anybody else how to live their lives or how this could work for them. I really don't want to say that. I just want to say that I am a case of a fairly radically transformed person, and I hope that that will somehow strike a chord with someone to share the transformations that they've been through. My story will also necessarily contain a spiritual component, because that's been the motive force for the changes in me, is the development and the establishment and the development of a living relationship with God is what has changed me. So I thought I'd start with facts as briefly as I can, just through my life, and then talk about the spiritual development that paralleled that. The facts are I started out as a very standard middle-class person. Nuclear family, lived in the suburbs. We basically lived the American dream. We had basically everything we needed, and we tried to be happy with that. I grew up in the 60s, the Vietnam era, as I became socially conscious, I guess you'd say. That was the time of experimenting with drugs, which I did a little bit of. More importantly, though, the time of Vietnam, which affected people's lives like crazy. I went back to high school a few years after I'd gotten out and was astounded at the difference in high school, because people were not spending all of their time wondering who was going to get drafted when, not trying to figure out how to keep from being drafted, not being mad because they knew they were going to be drafted. It was quite different. But the interesting thing is, as much as Vietnam was a part of my life and affected it in that era, I missed it politically, just totally. I knew there were people protesting it. I was against it, but on very pragmatic grounds. I didn't want my friends to go die in it. But as to elements of morality, larger perspective on it, forget it. I didn't know a thing. Just totally missed it. I think, was it 72 that we moved into Cambodia illegally? And there was some protest about that. And I finally thought, well, that's one thing too many. And I think I took part in a sort of low-key demonstration about that. But I was just absolutely apolitical. But somehow, as much as I seemed to want to just settle into average mediocrity, I wasn't left alone to do that. I had enough things happen to me to kind of keep me goosed and moving. And at one point, I was church hopping. I was looking for something. I knew I was And that was as close as I could come to looking for at the time, was just I seemed to want something. And so church hopping was a part of my life for 2 or 3 years as an addition to the rest of the things I was doing. I graduated from college with what might be called a useless degree in linguistics. I tried graduate school at UCLA for a whole month and a half and decided that that wasn't for me. There was too much competition. It was too far removed from the world. And I went back to being a secretary at the university in California where I had graduated in linguistics. And I tried to settle into a life of being a secretary, being full-time, working through the chairs, so to speak, till I ended up in a full-time, permanent, year-round position as a secretary, thinking, well, this isn't terrific, but I'll enjoy my time off camping, listening to music, having friends, going out to dinner, that kind of thing. That was as close as I could come to an image of what happiness was and what fulfillment was. Then I decided I didn't like being a secretary full-time, permanent, year-round at the university. It was too much work of the wrong kind. I decided I wanted to be outdoors. I moved to the state of Washington. Ended up being a gardener, a cook, and dishwasher for my uncle down in Chelan, where I have been for the last 6 years. Okay, that's just sort of facts on how I physically got here. At the time I moved up here, I started going to church just to take great aunts and my grandmother that had gone to church forever and ever, and I ended up going to the Methodist church, just a historical accident, and since then I've been quite happy with that. And about 4 months after I got here, a friend of mine from California, who had been working on me, so to speak, said the right thing, gave me the right things to read, and I became a Christian. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. I got excited about my own personal salvation, and then I looked around this stodgy Methodist congregation, and I said, what are these people doing here? They're not excited about anything. You know, this is joyful stuff. There was no hope, and now there's hope. There was no future, and now there's a future. Why aren't they excited? They weren't. I came that close to leaving that church and going to what would be termed a more fundamentalistic church, where there's a lot of clapping and shouting and joy in the aisles. And then I thought, well, that's kind of a chicken thing to do, to just get out because it isn't what I like. In the middle of a sermon, I went through all of this and I thought, I don't know what the sermon was about. And I thought, I'll stay and see if there's anything I can do with my youth at the time and my enthusiasm. That very day, and I sometimes wonder about this, that very day when I went up to talk to the pastor afterwards to say that I was concerned about the situation and that I wasn't really happy there, but I was going to stay and see what I could do. He said, there's going to be a bishop's convocation on the missional priorities of the Methodist Church, which at that time were evangelism, world hunger, and something else that I can't remember. He said, it'd be nice if you'd go, and I was, oh, that sounds boring. It really did. It just sounded awful. A bishop's convocation. I didn't know anything about connectional church. A bishop sounded like a very boring person to me. But I thought, well, I said I'd help out, so here I go, and I went. I went to this and ended up going to the World Hunger session, saw a film called I Want to Live about world hunger, and at one moment in that, there's just a picture of a woman and her child in Africa, and I just had this flash of a thought that said, no mother should have to sit and watch her child die of hunger or even be hungry. All this time I thought all of those problems were too big, so I didn't want to think about them, but I looked, there was just a moment where my heart got changed, I guess you'd call it, and I said, that can't be allowed to happen. Big statement, didn't have any idea what I was supposed to do with it, but I felt very strongly. The man who was doing the session on world hunger did a good job of bringing in a lot of related things, many of which we talk about here at Holden, most of which are very true, that have to do with world hunger being part of a political or part of an economic problem, a systemic problem that has to do with politics of this country, of countries around the world, and the interconnectedness of just about everything. And that's what happened to me, was I started finding that everything was interconnected, and everything was important, and everything was interesting. I read about economics in the paper when they talk about trade agreements and tariff barriers. I'd read that stuff because I knew that there were human lives involved in that. I went to a session called the, let's see if I can do it, EIEIO, the Emerging International Economic Order in Seattle. It was one of several regional gatherings. I got to have dinner with Secretary of State Vance with 800 other people, but I did have. And it was interesting to me. And the difference was that I knew it was people. It wasn't just figures and facts and things like that. As I went into all of this, I mean, it was just so big when I started, and I'm sure everybody feels that way. I thought, I don't even know where to start. But something in me moved me to start somewhere. I joined Bread for the World on the hunger issue. That started getting me into political stuff as I watched what makes people hungry and what doesn't. And political gets you into arms race almost automatically for me. Fear gets you into arms race. A lot of things, a lot of paths lead to the arms race. But I still see that as connected, that when we're spending money on arms, we're not spending money on people and food, things like that. Three issues, just to give you an example of the progress for me that might relate to some of the experiences you've had. One was the hunger thing. That was the first thing that had to do specifically with people being hungry. And as I say, that went into the political realm also. The arms race was more that I just, at one point in about, 1979, I believe it was, I read about Presidential Directive 59. And that was the one that said that our missiles were going to be aimed not at population centers as a deterrent to any attack from the Soviets, but our missiles would be aimed at their missile silos. And I said to myself, that must mean that our missiles are going to have to go before their missiles go, or our missiles won't do any good. At that point, I thought, I don't know a whole lot about deterrence, but I do know that it's not the American way to start wars. I don't care anything else. We have prided ourselves, at least consciously, on saying that we're the good guys. We're the defenders of liberty and justice. We are not the aggressors, not the attackers. And that for me was the moment in the arms race when I was thinking about the arms race that said, you have to stop this. You have to start fighting about it, fighting against it. The third issue, and this one is the most mysterious one to me, is El Salvador in Central America. For probably 3 years, I had been hearing about El Salvador, and there were a bunch of very intense people out there who were really concerned about it. And I'd hear that, and I'd sort of look at them, and it'd go in one ear and out the other. And then suddenly, just somebody said the right thing, and to this day, I can't tell you what it is. I maybe saw a film. Somebody had a conversation with somebody, and it was like, I don't really like the metaphor, but it seems very descriptive to me. It was like critical mass was reached on that particular topic. The moment that somebody said whatever that thing was, it all added up. I was then able to fit everything that I had heard before into that framework, and then go from there to learn more and more about it. Those are all three kind of different things. The hunger one was a single moment. The arms race was just a general concern that got specific. El Salvador was no concern at all that suddenly got real to me. And so here I am. I'm a garbologist. Because of all those interests, I'm now a garbologist at Holden. I am now very much concerned to spend my full time doing this, as I doing peace and justice, what I call for shorthand peace and justice work. I found myself in Chelan as this process developed. My spare time was spent doing community organizing and peace and justice. Started a peace group there, organized hunger walks, things like that, had demonstrations and so on. Well, it got so that my spare time was a lot longer than my gardening time, and I started to feel bad about that. So I thought, well, I need to do something full time. So I decided to come up to Holden to find out who's doing what in these kind of ministries and whether there's something I'd be useful at. Another thing that's kind of a fact about all this is that in two very obvious ways, I have been totally and absolutely and completely transformed. One of those is my shyness. Now, whenever I say to most people that know me that I used to be shy, they just laugh uproariously because they can't believe it, because I am totally extroverted now and comfortable with people and so on. I used to be so shy that if I walked into a high school class late or had to, I wouldn't go to the class. I couldn't stand to have everybody turn around and look at me for an eighth of a second and then turn back. I was that shy, and now that's totally changed. When I was in high school, I almost flunked all my English classes because I couldn't stand to write. I just had an absolute paralysis about writing. Now I can hardly not write. When there's something that I think needs to be said, I'll write articles for the paper or whatever. I haven't done very much of that because of limitations on my time, but that's one of the things that I think is a talent that should be developed. And it's just fascinating to see how those two things have been absolutely and completely and totally changed in my life. Those are some facts. Does anybody need to ask a question about any of that? I mean, is it coherent enough that you at least know the numerical order of everything? Okay. Spiritual development that went with all of that. Started out an agnostic, which is a way of saying I was too lazy to worry about religion. I went to...
Now I have a question.
What?
I'm trying to understand a son that's very active. He was at Vandenberg and Lemoore, he's an intelligent man, but he has absolutely no... he doesn't know that he believes in God. He believes in a force. But he was raised in the Lutheran Church, but never attended after he was adult and on his own. But I just don't understand him. He has no children. He's more concerned about his nieces and nephews surviving in this touchy
time. How old
is he? He's 35.
Good age. Great age.
Soon to be single.
I got first dibs, kid.
He would love everything about this environment except
religious.
The bell to go to Vespers. And is there any literature that you have or can recommend that will give him the spiritual side of what he's doing?
Is he active, you say, in the peace movement?
He's given up his law practice. He's totally committed to it.
Yeah.
His marriage is finished. That might not be the reason.
I don't have any answers, but I have seen a trend in the peace movement that I think is really exciting. And that is peaceable people from a whole lot of different directions are all kind of coalescing in the same place. And I suspect that what may happen, if he is from a Christian background, that what may happen is he's going to find some peaceable people that are doing it because they're Christians, and that may be enough of a witness to him to spark some. Who knows? I can't tell you. Nobody here can tell you what it is that some people are graced by the knowledge of God, and some people aren't.
The suspicion is that you can only pray that you will have an experience like her, that he will have an experience like hers, that somehow that also the right. He hears the right story at the right time that rings with true with him, and then comes crashing in.
It's the only thing that. But it. I don't know. I really strongly see God moving in the entire peace movement, and it's to me that's neat. And if God is truth, as I believe God is, then that truth will come out somewhere, sometime. There.
Thank you.
That's a concern. That's
the only thing I'd like to add to that.
This is another son.
My brother's name is Doug, and if you can just remember that, and sometime when you're walking around, think of him, and hopefully through the strength of the people that I've laid that concern on, together we'll be able to help him.
We might even close this with prayer, since I believe that's a very peaceable sort of thing to do. Okay, I started as an agnostic. My parents sent me to sent me basically to grade or Sunday school till I was about four, you know, nursery more than anything else. And then they got out of it, and I got out of it. So I grew up without anything to tie to in the way of religion. And I can remember just about as far back as I am capable of remembering that I was looking for a sense of connectedness, that things should fit together, that they should make sense. Even when I was 10, 8, 9 years old, things seemed too random. It just seemed like this happened, and then that happened, and then something else happened, and there wasn't any sense to it. Nothing like starting early and seeking. I found as I grew older, got to the point where I needed to start making some of my own decisions about religion and things, that a lot of the Eastern religions all through high school and early college appealed to me because they seemed to be talking about this sense of spirit that pervaded everything and was accessible to everyone if you just did the right things. And so that appealed to me. And the mystical side of what I call the mystical side of Christianity still appeals to me, where you are just sort of part of the force, the reality of God without words. I guess that's how I define mysticism. So that has continued with me. But all of this was really kind of vague. It was just something I was doing because I grew up in an era when you're supposed to be looking for yourself all the time. And it wasn't really until I had a crisis in my life that I realized how much I didn't know who I was or where I was going or anything else. I hit an absolute crisis, which forced me to start at least dealing with the psychological factors that were limiting my life then. I wasn't as far as doing anything spiritual, but at least I started on some of the psychological things. That process of starting to sort out some deeply buried and very important failings, faults, problems in me was really, as I look back, probably the first step in my spiritual development. It sort of brought me far enough off of the bottom that I could at least look around and see what was going on, that there were some other things to be offered. When I became a Christian, which was 6 years ago, I didn't really know what that meant. I had this friend who asked me a long distance on the phone after we'd had a discussion. She says, "Do you really believe that Jesus is the Son of God?" And somehow I knew that that was the statement I needed to make, and I said, "Yeah, I think so." I didn't know what that meant. No stars or bells or anything like that. It just was something that suddenly it sort of made sense to me, and I was willing to say that much. And she said, "Well, try reading this and that and that." She got me started in the Bible. I started going, actually really getting involved in our church now instead of just physically taking my relatives there. I got involved in a Bible study right away and so on. Okay, since then it's been a pathway, a journey, like we all have journeys in faith. We never arrive there, thank God. We just get to journey in joy. And I've gone through a lot of changes recently. Went through a really dry spell where I had gotten to the point, maybe for 2 years, that I was living a kingdom life as well as I could. I was affirming people, I was caring about causes, I was doing what I could, I was trying to be loving. But I sort of lost the presence of God, and it was really exciting, or a sense of the presence of God. And it was exciting to me over those 2 years, I mean 2 dry years, to know that what I had believed and known and felt so personally for the 3 or 4 years before that was so real that it maintained me and sustained me through this time. I had established the habits of believing in the kingdom of God, and that had worked for me, even though I didn't honestly feel what the kingdom of God was all about. It was like I was in that direction and that I wasn't going to be able to change. I was firmly, what's the word? There's a good word for it. Clasped by God, and thank God I stayed that way. I then went through, just very recently, a terrible time. I was very, very depressed for about a month. I didn't think I could ever do that again. I thought that my faith in God would somehow keep me safe. And it didn't. I went through a spell that was as bad as any I'd ever had 5, 6, 7 years ago. And somewhere in the very depths of it, I said, I'm still going to trust God. And that was the most important thing I've ever said in my life. Because if I could say it at that time, I can say it any time. And out of that came some creativity, some new ideas, and I ended up at Holden. And I'm now back, definitely, in God's presence, and I do appreciate the feeling a lot. But I don't need the feeling anymore. It's a reality to me. The most important thing that my faith has done for me is has ended fear. I found that out in the midst of that depression. That was the scariest thing that had happened to me since I've been a Christian. And it was scary enough because it brought back times when I was a hopeless person, a non-Christian, a person without any direction to go. When things went bad, there was no hope. In the midst of my Christianity, that same feeling came back. And I could say, it's okay. It's going to be okay. God's still in charge. If I could be fearless in that, then I think I'm going to be in pretty good shape for a while. Fear is the thing, I think, that stops many, many people from being able to be active on behalf of brothers and sisters all around the world. We're afraid of anybody who's different from us. We're afraid of people whose skin color is different. We can be afraid of welfare people for using our tax dollars. We can be afraid of rich people for oppressing us. We can be afraid of Russians because they're out to get us. We can be afraid of everybody that's different than us. And most of the people that we're afraid of are the people that need our help. The people that are just like us, particularly here at Holden, I think most of us are reasonably middle class, comfortable, waspish, of the ruling class, shall we say, in this country. We're not the ones that really need the help. It's the welfare people, the people that are too rich, it's the people that are our enemies, it's the people who are of different skin color than we are, it's the people who are different than us that we probably need to be working on behalf of more than anybody else. I had gotten, just before I moved up here, to the point that my fear was getting very obvious. I was uncomfortable around a lot of people. Because there's nobody just like me, nobody just like anybody in this room. So it was easy to be afraid. If you allow yourself to be afraid of everything that's different than you or anything that's different, then there's a lot of things to be afraid of out there. That to me was probably the biggest step that I took, and it was not a fast one at all. It was probably a reasonably slow one. If I walk down the streets in Seattle now and I see a street person, that used to bother me immensely. They're going to embarrass me. They're going to try to steal something from me. People are going to think we're friends. I don't know, you know, just threatened by that kind of differentness. And now all I do is I see people like that and I say, there's somebody who needs love. And I really do feel that way. I don't always carry it out. I have all kinds of human limitations, as I always will, unfortunately, but I will try to love a lot of different people that I used to be afraid of. I have refined that recently in a way that is really important to me. I've gotten involved in the arms race, fighting that as one of the main things I do just because of the intensity and the urgency of that issue. I'd rather be worrying about world hunger. I'd rather be doing a lot of other things, but that seems to be urgent enough that I want to work on it almost full time. But out of that, I've gone from just policy making, just letter writing, just that kind of thing, to the idea of personal peacemaking. That peace in the world will start with individual peace among people, including us, everyone in this room with each other. The idea of reconciliation, that is a spiritual idea, the idea of through Christ, humankind being reconciled to God. That is getting more real to me. I understand what that means, and the fact that we can be reconciled to each other because of the power of the Holy Spirit. All of that is getting to be very important for me, that I'm not so much looking at big issues out there as just one-on-one how I can get along with somebody and how other people can get along with me. Just to sum up, life used to be an ordeal to be endured for me, essentially, or on good days, it was a neutral thing. And now, I like the theme for this summer, the idea of the Feast of Life, because that is really how I feel in everything that I do, the social action, the garbology, everything that I do, I feel the interconnectedness of it. I feel the sense of God wanting to reconcile all of creation to God. And I feel a part of that. I'm not an expert. I'm not highly trained in anything. I don't have any credentials at all. I have my humanity, and that's really all that I have to offer. But it seems to have been enough to do amazing things when I look back on what I was doing before in my life. So that's basically what I have to say. I'm hoping that this will open some discussions, some journeys you people have made or not made or would like to make. And I don't have answers. This is, talk to each other. Don't just talk to me.
I just want to draw on your experience specifically to deal with peace, the marches, whatever. My wife and I marched last June 12th, I guess it was, in the big peace march.
Oh, really?
And the thing that came out of the feedback afterward, and they live in a small town where kind of everybody knows each other, that sort of thing. And the feedback came back, well, the guys down at the VFW were mad at the police chief for blocking the streets so we could walk across at a busy intersection. Mm-hmm. That type of thing. Do we confront people like that and just on the open level and march whether they want us to march, or do we talk to them one-on-one? Is there a strategy to...
Good question. I had a similar experience recently, and I'm not sure what my decision is about it yet. Went down to Hanford for the first Hanford demonstration, which is a nuclear reserve in the southeast corner of the state of Washington, where they are building, they have a plant now that will create plutonium. It's purely plutonium for weapons. That's all it's good for. It's not a power station or anything. And we had the first ever demonstration down there, 30 people holding up signs next to the road. And we had 10,000 people mad, I mean mad, at us, shouting obscenities and everything else. And I sat there and I thought about it. And I thought, is it nice that we're making people feel that way? But for me, I think the key is that we have the idea of time. I sat there and all the people that were there, I was really pleased to see it, all the demonstrators were accepting the abuse peacefully. You would sit there and somebody would flip you off and you'd smile at them and say thank you. And as the afternoon wore on, you meant it more and more and more. You thought, well, I have the right to sit here and give my opinion with this sign, and they have their right to give their opinion. And the answer that I came up with is that it needs to be a continuing thing, that they may react that way at first. If the demonstrators, the people that feel strongly, just keep coming back, steadily, whether it's in their own communities, not necessarily back to New York all the time, in their own communities, keep doing what they need to do in a loving way and being willing to dialogue at any time with anybody who walks up to abuse them. I think it's useful and realistic to do that. That's my own opinion. Anybody else have feelings about that?
Recalls the one of the closing scenes in the film Gandhi. Mm. I don't know how authentic that scene actually was. It really just came on wave after wave.
Mm-hmm.
And that salt strikes.
Yeah, that could have been making
those
people really
mad.
Well,
that's
really
very authentic, though.
Yeah.
That's quite authentic. It also demonstrates. It also demonstrates the theme.
It's quite authentic, so I assume it might have been. Well, I thought that was very impressive, and that seems to me
and
a Christian stance. A very, very painful one, a very costly one.
Yeah, that film has had a great effect on me, as I'm sure it has on a lot of people here, to really see that nonviolence what is it, active non-participate, or non-participation, non-non? Yeah, that's right. Has a lot of power to offer peace groups, people who want to make war, all kinds of people. That's something I'm continuing to study. But that is, I mean, the prophets got people mad. Jesus got people mad. I think that's the tradition we have to follow in. As long as it's done in a caring, loving way for the right reasons, then probably it's okay.
Yeah. Have you read the book, The Original Revolution? Mm-hmm. Have you read it, Luke?
No, I haven't. It's the one John Howard Yoder
book. John Howard Yoder book.
Yeah.
Well, I haven't read it either, but I've gotten started with it. And so I can't be sure of what he said. In other words, I have to read things a couple, three times to ensure I know it, just like I have to see a movie about three times to know what it said. But what I think it said was this. It was speaking about the situation that Jesus faced when he began his ministry. And he had four options to escape. He had the option of going along like the Pharisees were, trying to accommodate themselves to the ruling class, the Romans, try to get along with them, and run your church, and kind of keep things going on an even keel. You had the choice of also being a zealot, as many, some of his, I guess most of his disciples were. As it says in there, they had a small revolution about every generation, with little consequence to it. Another option he had was to just go off into the desert or go off by himself and live a life of a recluse, but...
Ascetic.
There?
An ascetic.
Something like that. The fourth was the one that he chose to do, which is to try to live a life like God. In other words, anything that he did or said, as I understand it, was what God, if he was in prison, would have done or said.
That's all you have to do, Bob.
That's as far. But of course, he gets to do many of the things that we see people doing today under the guise of resistance and movement and that sort of thing. He had no, I guess, one thing that you could say where he got a little mad was the scene with the money changers in the temple. It was about the one time that you could say he really lost his cool, if you would. But as I say, I haven't read, finished the book. But it seems to me that that's what he's saying. Now, I'm not saying that that is 100% correct, but it's theologically correct or anything like that. But it suggests that one's actions take place in the way you conduct yourself on a day-to-day basis in regard to every little thing that comes up, comes along. At work, at play, at wherever. And I guess the reason I raise the question is perhaps that my perception is correct. It's something that maybe all of us could read and contemplate whether or not that says, and anybody says, well, gee, what can I do? Well, this says, here is what one man suggested, is recommended or practiced that anybody can do. And it doesn't require cutting fences and finding barbed wire and all that sort of stuff. I don't know enough about John Howard Yoder to know whether he is recognized, but I see he's been here and he's written a lot, and somebody seems to think he's on the right track, I guess. I don't know.
Dean?
Well, in reading just a little bit, mostly contemplating the issue this week and last year during a week similar to this, and not really getting too involved, I think my brother, one we were alluding to earlier, would probably say to us, don't be afraid to cut the barbed wire and to do the nonviolent civil disobedience type thing, because you don't have to be afraid of that issue. That's down in California at Vandenberg, where they're protesting the MX missile. It's a very, very well planned situation. My brother is a lawyer by degree, a farmer by desire, and he's giving up both of those to go take on this thing that's very, very important to him. But with a plan. When he went in and jumped the fence and got arrested, he knew that there were, you know, enough lawyers within the group on the outside that he wouldn't be too bad. You know, so they took, I think, 6 of them or 9 of them and put them, they went to the same place the guys, the water heat did down there. He said it wasn't too bad, you know, in 3 days. The judge that tried it said, how do you plead, you know, no contest to it, basically. And he said, okay, 3 day sentence, which was the time they were in, with time served and they released. And he said that the judge basically sympathized with them and said, you know, I realize what you're doing and I agree with what you're doing. We do have civil laws, so I do have to, you know, enter some kind of a judgment against you. But basically, keep it up. So that's the kind of thing you don't have to have the fear. I'm not to that point yet.
Of course, when his mother learned that one of the places it was Terminal Island, that was frightening in itself.
But, you know, that's the kind of thing. So in being socially, a social activist, I guess that's the thing that you want to make sure of. That number one, from a Christian perspective, the thing that you're protesting against meets the criteria similar to what Larry had this morning. And it meets your own personal criteria. Civil disobedience is not something that I would do at this point. I don't know that all lawful means of protest will be enough. But I know there are some people with that conviction. But this week, okay, I read somewhere, and I'll just kind of try to paraphrase. God said after the flood that he would no longer, he wouldn't come back and do that again. He would not, you know, destroy everything on the earth. The rain, that it was basically our situation. It's now to the point where we have it in our control, in human control, to literally obliterate the world. We have become, through our technology, our secular society has developed this situation that we can, you know, take that power and just do the godly thing to the world and eliminate it. And if it takes a human thing like cutting a fence or, you know, running in somewhere where you're not supposed to be, maybe that's what it's going to take. Change it.
What did that accomplish all day? Start to cut fence.
The same kinds of things that Berkeley caused in the 60s.
Was that good?
Yes.
Got us out of Vietnam.
Put an end to the war in Vietnam. We're not going to get...
Why do you say no? I mean, rather than trading opinions as to whether, what would you cite as your evidence that it got us out, and what would you cite as your evidence that it didn't get us out? Because otherwise all we're going to do is I think one thing and you think another thing, and we can bounce back and forth, you know, from now till the cows come home. But each of us ought to be obligated to give some account for that opinion.
Well, my perception simply is that it's politically expedient to get it shut off some way or another. And that's what the government did. Why was it politically expedient? That's the basic question, then, I guess. I think everybody got one of those quicksand deals. You're getting in deeper and deeper, and how in the devil you're going to get out? And so somebody decided we're going to get out.
Can I ask one
question?
It wasn't
very honorable getting out, I know. But
why hasn't it become politically expedient for us to get out of Central America?
I don't understand that. I'm trying to say, I listened to this, and I'm trying to say I don't understand the situation down there because I've never been there. All I know about is what I read in the paper, and I admit that that's a poor source. I have no contact, no way to evaluate the situation at all. I I just don't know.
I would suggest it's because there aren't enough people who have decided to evaluate it through Christian eyes and get loud enough about it and complain enough about it. But that's because I agree with Dean anyway. Dean, go ahead.
Okay. Things go better with Coca-Cola. You deserve a break today. All of those things are from advertising. And the only way that where you're going to get the coverage that this thing needs is to bring it up in the news media. And the only way you do that is to create enough of a problem that more people hear about it. And I agree with you, it was politically expedient to get out of the war in Vietnam, but that's simply because people were going to be voted out of office if something wasn't done. And that pressure came from a heightened awareness, and the awareness came from the fact that we had Berkeley's and we had Kent State's and all the other things that went during the
except that Richard Nixon ran on his platform in 1968 that it was that the war was a mistake and we should be out of there and everything. It took him to 1973 before he got a truth on it, so it was politically expedient. He was already in his second term.
That's because in 68 the platform was not just to get out, but it was that he had a secret plan and the war, if you remember, took him 4 years to discover his own secret.
It was a deep secret.
I agree with protests, and I'm just convinced that that brought him.
I think it's important for us to remember, though, that not everybody is called to protest. Not everybody is called to civil disobedience. There are so many ways to bear witness to peace, many, 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 most of which maybe are legal. You can do it just by talking to people about things, you know. El Salvador isn't going to be an issue unless people make it an issue. The arms race. I've had incredible experiences with my uncle, who is very conservative, very much believing our government knows something nobody else does, that they're the experts. And I've just talked to him and been concerned about him. And talk to him some more, and he's now quoting me to me, which is always funny. Well, everybody knows that so-and-so is true, but what about this? You know, and what he said is true is something I said to him in the right way at the right time, that it struck him as true. You know, I didn't coerce him or anything. I just said what I thought was true enough times that it hit him, and he said, yeah, I guess that's true. And I think that's important.
Can we, just for the sake of the record, can we make a distinction between public protest and civil disobedience?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was gonna
they are not the same thing. I mean, there's obviously a constitutionally guaranteed right to the citizens to gather peacefully in the streets and say their piece. There's nothing civilly disobedient about that. I guess I would want to argue from the standpoint of Lutheran theology that any citizen who doesn't exercise that right is faulty. I mean, because that's one of the mechanisms of governance, and citizens do not have the right to give that up. It's precisely that mechanism of governance that is a call from God to do something. Civil disobedience is another matter. Mm-hmm.
And it's a phenomenon. I don't know if it was true so much before, but it's very, very prevalent now, particularly in Christian peace groups, is there'll be 10 people that go over the fence or walk in, you know, do whatever it is that's illegal, and there'll be 100 people supporting them that are totally legal, they're where they're supposed to be, they're peaceable, and peaceful, and they're just there to support the people that have felt called to civil disobedience. As far as I have gone so far as not paying some of my taxes. I didn't pay half of my taxes last year, $56 whole. And so I'm going to let IRS get hassled, you know, and hassle me, and they'll end up probably taking it out of my savings account, or maybe they won't. I don't know. No, I know people that it has happened, but maybe not for that amount. That was just something that it took me about a year after I first thought of that possibility to finally learn enough about it, what the options were, what the consequences might be, to be educated as to what that meant. And then I knew I was ready to do it. But I'm not ready to go over a fence or climb into Bangor or something to get arrested. Tim Kishnick here in the village did just that. He went into Bangor, he and John Nelson and another man whose name I can't remember, rode a little boat, powered it in to the submarine base in Bangor over here on the Puget Sound. He was ready for that. Different people would be different places, but there's a lot of legal things that we can do. Is there anybody here that feels like they're kind of at a decision point about anything like that, as to whether to get involved or how much deeper to get involved in any of the social action things? Are you struggling? Anybody struggling with a decision on that by any chance?
Well, I've made a decision. My decision is that the Pentagon wastes more money and Carter has pills. And therefore, without even getting into the question of it, that's why I thought Eisenhower was a great president. He knew enough to tell the Pentagon, here's all the money you get, and by George, you live with it. Mm-hmm. And that thing is getting to be such a monstrosity of extravagance and waste, in my opinion. I can't prove it, Lou. I can't prove a thing except that
Time Magazine, November
1983. Well, I don't even need to read Time Magazine, because I know people negotiate government contracts and from that peripheral vantage point. And my own clearly unbiased opinion of the military is that if you cut $200 billion, whatever it is the budget is, right out of the military budget, right to begin with. They talk about, you know, we've got to save money in these various other areas to cut down the deficit and interest rates and so on. I could cut the deficit really easily. And I'm convinced without knowing a doggone thing about it, it wouldn't affect national defense on paper. But they had some, really had to be more stringent the way they managed the money. So I can support, and I've written my congressman, and he has reacted in his customary fashion. Glad to hear from you. Be glad to write me anytime you want.
I'll vote any way I want.
And I'll vote any way I want to.
One thing that's always bothered me, I lived through the Cambodia incident and was hoping to get on the faculty at Stanford University and was afraid the students were going to burn down the wooden experimental dwelling we worked in and so on at that time. And I sympathized with some of the movements and didn't sympathize with some of the very crude methods that some of the students used. But as I went through all that, what bothered me was that so many people seemed so utterly convinced that they knew the exact solution, that it was totally black and white. We should be here. We should not be here. The Pentagon should spend so much money. The Pentagon should spend more money. Everyone seems to know exactly the solution. I never knew the exact solution. I could see some trends, and the best I can hope for, and I really respond to some of these movements that do seem to be Christian-based, that seem to be prayer-based, because I think they can push for a positive influence in the same way that we must hope that our loving God is looking to us to look to Him in a positive way. You know, it doesn't happen today or tomorrow. There may even be a Holocaust. Maybe we'll all be gone. But if you're Christians, we'll be prepared. And we will have done something along the way to push it in the right direction.
I think that there's a big difference between the protest movements now and in the 60s. I think people learned a lot from the 60s. I don't know. I wasn't really that aware of what was going on. But as I look back on it, it's kind of like a lot of the people, particularly Christians, but I don't want to be exclusive about that, are saying, well, there was more violence than there should have been in some of those demonstrations. And they're saying, if what we're protesting for is peace, then our protest has to be peaceful. And I think the history of the recent, say the last year and a half, of peace movements all over the world has been astoundingly nonviolent. I was appalled. What was it? I read something just the other day that, was it West Germany? I believe there was some rock throwing incidents there at a peaceful demonstration. And I was really shocked and bothered by that, because I think that the movement has been more consistently peaceful than anything that came out in the 60s.
Of course, another thing that's different is the thing that makes peace movement, I think, much more credible now than the anti-Vietnam demonstrations a lot of times were, is that at this point in time, well, then it was clear that a lot of people demonstrating, it was their own skin, it was their own self-interest that was being served by saying, let's get out. Whereas now, you know, we're not, we haven't been drafted. We're trying to say, look where we're going. It's not the same. It's a different kind of situation. And I think it is being done with a much more preparation, consideration.
I think one of the main things that changed what I did with my life, in addition to the spiritual thing, was just somewhere along the line it occurred to me that we don't have just this sort of lofty place where all the experts hang out and make policy and they know something we don't know. I really just have totally lost that belief now. I believe that every citizen in this room has got some input for the decision making on many, many, many issues. There may well be hordes of people in the Pentagon that know more about the technical side of the arms race, that know about throw weight and about numbers of warheads and all that, although I've gleaned a lot of that in the years that I've been looking at it. But they don't have any perspective. They've lost the ability to make moral judgments about what they do. They have lost, you know, here they are, they're saying, we're fighting to preserve the American way of life. And what is that? What is their solution? Let's all kill everybody on the planet. And that doesn't seem too sensible to me. And that's all I can see, is that they're not thinking very clearly. And so maybe that's the role that...
I think to some degree the last thing that you say has been the angle that's been pointed up by the people working out of the Center for Defense Information in Washington, I mean, which is staffed largely, if it's not entirely, but very largely by former military people who have pretty much said exactly that kind of thing, that internally we have a mass of technical data and everybody's able to manipulate the technical data, but in abstract from any kind of serious moral consideration. And that consideration is not the private possession of technocrats of any kind.
Well, another thing is what was brought up in your session the other day on a tape that I heard Dan's, is a theological perspective is to examine this as to not, whether or not this is not another example of principalities and powers that are spoken of in the New Testament, where it is beyond what any of us would acknowledge as reasonable and right by ourselves, but somehow once it becomes systematized, it gets out of hand, even by those who claim to control it.
It's 10 o'clock, it's break time for people that want to leave, if you want to stay.
Just one thing, there's also the Office of Confession.
10:15, yeah.
But one, have any of you seen the film War Without Winners?
I
very frankly think it's a far better presentation than Gods of Metal. Far better.
War Without Winners.
War Without Winners is the title of it. I'm pretty sure it's available through the Center for Defense Information. But there's this one remarkable scene that I think really portrays what you're just talking about, and I'd just like to offer it. They do an interview with the guy who operates this computer bank that's like 30 feet below ground, concrete encased in the Pentagon. And the interviewer says to this guy, what's this computer about? And the guy says, this computer has all of the local times of the target sites of our missiles in the Soviet Union on it. And he says, and the guy says to him, well, you know, what's that all about? And he said, well, that's in case there's an accident and the missile goes off accidentally, we will be able to tell the people in the Soviet Union in their own local time what time they're going to get hit. And the interviewer says to the guy, this is literally the kind of thing, the interviewer says to the guy, do you think that's going to make him feel any better? And this guy's response is, well, not everybody in the world understands Greenwich Mean Time and is able to make the computation. That's the response. And I think that's the kind of thing that you're talking about, what in terms of principalities and powers. I mean, the whole thing gets framed in some kind of technical, mechanical process, and there's no notion anymore that, I mean, you're really talking about a couple hundred thousand people going to be vaporized, you know? I mean, that's just sort of dismissed. It's a terrific
thing. That's the American way. My father was in the defense industry for 30 years. The last 3 years of that, he built cruise missiles. We finally had some discussions once I figured out what was going on. Right after he retired, he had a chance to go back and work temporarily for a few months. And at that time, he wrote me a letter. He said, I'm not working on anything nuclear, and I don't, you know, I never would. That was me having a conversation with him 30 years too late. And I can remember growing up that the technocracy was the way that we went, that you just did what you did on your job and you didn't think about the consequences.
That's not just an American problem, it's a Western problem.
Yeah.
Your Center of Defense Information, I think they're the one that recently got out this global map.
Probably so.
Which showed on it the areas and the land areas that are covered, that are facing number one, civil strife, number two, border wars, number three, something else. So the three categories of people. And practically the whole world is covered. And nobody's fired a nuclear missile. We've got a basic problem, a peace, that it goes far beyond, in my opinion, the question of what size rocks we're throwing at each other. And that's why I think the idea that we're debating an issue, which is, I'm not going to use the word superficial, but if we're really going to cure this thing, we've got to get back to what causes people to shoot anything at each other.
I see hope, though, in the whole nuclear thing. That's why I think the peace movement is so broad-based, is that what's happening is the powers and the principalities have come out in the open. And when we look at the ultimate reality of violence as an answer to strife, we're looking at nuclear weapons, and now people are able to look at that clearly and say, this is not right, this is evil, and it's got to stop. And until it got to this ultimate, perfect, and total destruction stage, we could put up with the little wars and the little weapons.
The people who are anti-nuclear are anti for various reasons.
Oh, yeah.
Some of them are peace. Some of them, they think the budget's too high. Others have got other reasons. So we've got
but I've seen a lot of people that started worrying about the budget and realized after a while that it was a moral question. I think that's an important point.
The budget is a moral question.
Huh?
The budget is a moral question.